Welcome to Kay Gas Processing Horizon podcast. My name is Kay, a story writer, film researcher, and avid horror aficionado. In my podcasts, I will be rigorously focusing on every aspect of cinematic horror with interviews, analysis, and short stories. Join me in untying the soul's strings of darkness, exploring the human mind's abyss and their filmic psychological projections. Tonight, Michelle Satchwell comes back once more with, as always, intriguing information regarding Friday the 13th as a day and as a film. Is it actually an unlucky day? Does it still have an impact on us and the society we live in? What is it that made it a great horror film back then, and why is it still considered cult today? Michelle gives chilling and thrilling answers to everything you need to know about a day and a film that still haunt us to this day. Without further ado, here's the interview. Hi Michelle, and welcome back on my show once more. Is there a significance of Friday the 13th as a day in the Gregorian calendar?
I did some research into kind of how frequently it occurs. And it's surprisingly frequent. So a lot of people see it's quite rare. Like, for instance, this year, there's only one Friday the 13th in August. Next year, there's only one in May. But there's lots of maths and numerology into this. And it was saying that there's 28 combinations of days and dates that occur more frequently than other day and date combinations. And Friday the 13th was one of those. The least common was Wednesday the 31st. Don't know why. And then I got really carried away. I was looking at all the differences of when it happens. So any month that begins on a Sunday would have a Friday the 13th. And then in terms of the years, the shortest time you could have between maybe two Friday 13th is February and March. And there when a normal year starts on a Thursday, in that year you'd have February, March and November would have a Friday the 13th then. Or when a leap year starts on a Sunday. So I thought that was pretty cool. The longest we've ever gone without one is 14 months. And that's when a normal year starts on a Tuesday or when a leap year starts on a Saturday. So they are relatively frequent compared to other day and date combinations. But it, you know, it does occur at least once every year, up to three times a year is the maximum. So hence this year, with there only being one Friday the 13th, we've got to make the most of it.
What is the history behind that day?
Ah, well, I spoke to one of my very good friends who's a history teacher, and I used to teach history with him in my old school, and he taught Year 7 and 8, but he teaches GCSE and A-level, and he was telling me there's lots of different kind of historical references to Friday the 13th. With most things, it tends to be a religious connotation. So, for instance, the Last Supper had 13 guests, the last one being Judas. And in Christianity, we see what then went on to happen. But then if you ask, well, why Friday? You know, if we can understand the 13, why Friday? You can look at the day of Jesus's crucifixion was also on a Friday, Good Friday. So you can kind of put those two things together, the Last Supper and the crucifixion, to be Friday the 13th. He also talked about Norse mythology, and he talked about a similar kind of aspect of the last meal, that there was 12 gods and Loki was the 13th guest who wasn't invited and he wasn't happy, and then what came from that onwards. So perhaps maybe some of these religious aspects have, you know, been passed through generations and generations. Again, there's not much evidence, you know, for the Friday and the 13th combination, but there is for Friday. So in Christianity, they believe that's when Eve gave Adam the apple. And obviously that was the undoing of humanity. Cain killed his brother Abel as well on a Friday. So there seems to be a couple of things that, you know, religious wise have gone wrong on a Friday or in relation to the number 13. And perhaps that's just been passed down. The most deadly day in reality in the UK is a Tuesday, according to David Wilson, who's a criminologist at Birmingham University, and he does a lot of programmes on Channel 5 as well, that there's more murders occur on a Tuesday than any other day. And so there's no reason to genuinely be afraid of Fridays particularly. But then there's other kind of things that have happened throughout history. So King Philip IV of France, he kind of captured the Knights Templar, who, you know, were protecting Christianity and were very powerful. And he captured them, and then there was the massacre of them that followed afterwards. And then some people have also suggested from numerology that perhaps it's because 12 is such a lovely number, which sounds really daft, but it's such a complete number. So, for instance, you have 12 months in the year, there's 12 signs of the zodiac, there's 12 days of Christmas, the 12 apostles, you know, that's such a complete number. And then other numerologists talk about it in terms of it being easily divisible. So you can divide it by 4, by 3, by 2. That because 12 is such a complete and whole number, that when 13 then follows afterwards, it's such a kind of risky, uncomfortable number. And that could be why people don't feel comfortable with it. To link a little bit to psychology, because when I was doing my research, I couldn't believe I'd talk about a woman called Kitty Genovese, who was murdered in New York in America. And I knew it was in 1964. But she actually was murdered on Friday, the 13th of March, 1964. And she was murdered quite famously. It's called the bystander apathy effect, where she kept getting stabbed and then the assailant would run away. No one would do anything and he would come back and continue to stab her. And ultimately that led to her death. And it was investigated why no one in the New York apartment stopped or intervened. And it was bystander apathy. They just waited for everybody else to kind of do something, and therefore nobody does anything. But there are loads of other instances throughout history that have had this Friday the 13th. So, for instance, the German bombing of the Buckingham Palace in September 1940, and there was 300,000 people killed in a cyclone in Bangladesh in 1970. You know, there was the Chilean Air Force plane disaster in 1972. Tupac Shakur, who people might be aware of, he was killed in 1996 on Friday the 13th. The Costa Concordia, the cruise ship, back in 2012, just off the coast of Italy, where 30 people died. That was Friday the 13th. So maybe, you know, we've started off with that religious part. Then there's been, you know, a few events in history. And then all of these have come together to make people genuinely fear Friday the 13th. However, in psychology, we would call that confirmation bias, that we're only reporting the ones where those things have happened on Friday the 13th. And there's lots of cases where, you know, bad things have happened and it hasn't been a Friday the 13th. So most obvious example, 9/11 in America was not on a Friday or the 13th. So sometimes we look for evidence that backs up that argument. And we do that through our thought processes, and we call that it's a cognitive bias, but its name here would be confirmation bias, that you look only to the evidence that supports and confirms your point, and therefore you ignore anything that goes against that.
Is it a Western society's superstition, or do we encounter it elsewhere in the world as well?
It is Friday the 13th specifically. Seems to be a Western trait, so kind of America, the UK. In other countries, other days are also seen as superstitious. And also kind of if you go to, because everything we talk about is always Western superstitions, but if you go to Asia or more specifically China, they also have their superstitions. So they really don't like the number four, because the way that they pronounce the number four sounds similar to death. So for them, that's such an unlucky number, more so than probably the impact of Friday the 13th, because it'll be to the point that they won't have apartments that are numbered the number four. There'll be 3A or 13A. They'll skip the number four. Or their elevators won't have a fourth floor. They just skip straight from third to fifth. Even so, in Chinese culture, certain numbers are seen as so lucky kind of the opposite, that it makes that person more rich, more wealthy, if they have one of their lucky numbers. So, for instance, number 8 is seen as really lucky because that's classed as a complete number. It's eternal. It's always flowing in Taoist culture. But we also see that then if they have the number 8 in their phone number or their security ID, that they then will be more prosperous as a person. And even property prices, if they have the number 8 in their house or in their street name or their postcode equivalent, then their house is more wealthy compared to someone who's got the number 4 in those. So it's not only a Western superstition. I think across the world, we have these fascination with numbers, that some numbers we like, some we don't. There's a theory in psychology that we prefer even numbers, that that's just a thing, that odd numbers are, they make us uncomfortable. So, for instance, in the novel 1984, he talks about room 101 being so horrible, or when you've got the meaning of life being 42. It's because we have a preference for even numbers, that we like them because they're easy to play around with, that you can multiply them easily, you can divide them easily, you can work with them. And even though they're numbers which are objective, and I teach all the time in social sciences, numbers, you know, are objective, they're scientific, whereas we as humans place meaning on them. So we make numbers become subjective. So we add this meaning to them, that even products, even numbers, sorry, are better than odd numbers. And there's some research by a person called Dan King in California who said that people will buy more products if they have an even number in the title than if it's an odd number. So there's something we just aren't comfortable with odd numbers. But then weirdly, when you look at lucky numbers, some of those are odd, especially in Western traditions, like lucky number 3 or lucky number 7 in casinos on slot machines. It's always the 777. So it's a really confusing relationship that we've got with numbers, that 3 is seen quite negatively, bad things come in 3, or, you know, oh, it's a third celebrity that's died. We focus on those bad things come in 3s, but we also focus on 3 positively. Third time lucky, third time a charm. So we have this really weird connection with numbers that I don't think is just a Western thing. I think it's, you know, people trying to make sense of the world around them and how numbers represent their world.
I was meant to ask you if that day is a day we should be preoccupied with, but the way you describe it, we are being preoccupied with. So my question is, why are we still preoccupied with that day? Are we trying to blame a particular day or number for what is happening to us? Are we blaming forces in general beyond our understanding and control, so we don't have to blame ourselves?
No, I totally agree. Yeah, I think it's a way of us trying to kind of make sense of that world around us. So we'll always look for meanings. That's what humans do. We always try to understand the meaning of life, the meaning why we're here, what's our purpose, and numbers are treated in that same way, rather than just look at numbers for what they are, a way of representing information. We can't help but, you know, look for further information from them to add our own meanings to them. And I think that is partly because in a world that's so what appears to be random, it's actually probably not arguably that random, but in a world that's so random and so uncontrollable, it gives us that sense, feeling of control, kind of that false feeling of control, that we think we therefore have understood the world because we've got that control. We have that superstition. We have our lucky number 3 on us, or we've kind of broke away from the odds. It's almost like we make deals with ourselves, or, you know, if you're religious, with God, that you make these deals that, you know, just like people have superstitious socks or pants or whatever it might be, that if you've kind of focused on a certain number, if you've received that number, then that's a message, and then that means something for you, and that's you understanding the world a little bit more and being able to control the world around you. But in reality, we don't have arguably that much control, especially from a psychology point of view. We would see the world as being very determined, that most aspects of life are out of our control. So it would make sense that somebody might feel uncomfortable with that, and therefore they would like to grasp on to that feeling that they do understand the world and that they do have some control, because they've done these superstitious acts or rituals, or, you know, looked at certain numbers that day, that then gives them an element of free will in a world that's pretty much determined.
That reminds me, as I don't eat meat, every time I go somewhere and ask if they have anything without meat, a frequent response is, "Are you vegetarian?" or "Are you vegan?" It's tempting sometimes, and I say, "No." And then there's this awkward silence where they're probably thinking, "Oh, if you're not vegetarian, or if you're not vegan, then what are you?" It feels like we have to label everything so we can put it into context, otherwise we don't understand it.
Yeah, they can't understand that because they haven't got a schema for that. They haven't got, basically a schema is just a folder of memory. So they'll have a folder for vegans and a folder for vegetarians and a folder for religious people not eating meat. But if you've just chose not to eat meat, that doesn't sit within one of their schemas. So they can't process it. And in a world that's what we class as cognitive overload, there's so much information with the internet and globalization and all of this, we then can't process that information at the speed that we want to, because it doesn't fit neatly into one of our schemata or one of our folders.
I wish I could fully understand it, but anyway, everything needs to fit into little boxes, otherwise it's discarded. Is this day somehow related to Tuesday the 13th?
In the same way as Friday the 13th has its superstition kind of rooted in religion, Tuesday the 13th is kind of similar to that. It's similar kind of roots. And Tuesday the 13th in Greek culture, Hispanic culture, tends to be the day of superstition. In Italy, they have a different day for them. It's Friday the 17th. And this is what we were saying before, how each culture seems to have their own fixation, their own reason, their own kind of something has happened in history or something's happened in religion that has then made that day be an association of negativity, which then, you know, through word of mouth, through passing down, through family members, through observing family members and social learning theory, we then come to also become fearful of it. So, for instance, in Greece, there was the fall of Constantinople to the Ottomans in 1204, which occurred on Friday the 13th. There was also, you know, the idea of the god of war, Ares, domination around that time. Also, the third day being treaty and bad things coming threes, as we mentioned, when three is seen as an unlucky number. And then for Italians, Friday the 17th is an unlucky day, because if you look at the Roman numerals, so for the 17th, you would have the X and then the V and then the 1-1 for the 17. If you reorder those into the V, the I, the XI for the Roman numerals, then that actually reads in Latin as "my life is over." So hence they see this, anything to do with 17 is really deadly, really dangerous. So there always seems to be, regardless of the day or the number, there always is kind of a starting point, as there is with, you know, most kind of superstitions. Well, according to behaviorists, there's always an initial negative association because they believe everything's learned in the environment. So there's always that first moment where something bad occurred on that day. And then through kind of what we'd call operant conditioning, so through avoiding those moments, through kind of, for instance, one of those social impacts is that people are less likely to go out on Friday the 13th in Western culture. So because they're less likely to go out, they avoid the thing that they're afraid of, which then makes them more afraid. It basically strengthens their fear. And that's through a process called negative reinforcement. it's negative because you're taking yourself away, you're removing yourself, you're staying indoors, and it reinforces that fear. It tells that fear to be stronger. The opposite is when we do positive reinforcement, where you might train a dog and you give them a treat, and then that encourages, that strengthens that behavior of sitting or whatever it might be. So it seems throughout kind of all of these different cultures, and it does show how it's a very strong argument for how phobias are learned and how superstitions are learned, because we have that evidence that different cultures have different days and different numbers, where they've had that initial negative association, then they've had that negative reinforcement, and then they've just made sure, you know, through time, that's then probably been passed on through social learning theory, which is where you observe your role models. So, for instance, observing my parents, where they used to say things like, touch wood, you know, if you've talked about somebody, or you might have jinxed yourself, must touch wood. And we couldn't move on until someone had touched wood. And obviously, as a child, I would watch and observe that. And hence, I would then copy it and imitate it. Even now, as a psychologist, and I know that, you know, there's nothing, it doesn't matter whether I touch that wood or not, I'll still touch the wood. Because we do, as I say, have this kind of deal with ourselves that we're so fearful of jinxing something. And it's a little ritual that we perform that makes us feel good. So in that way, it's positively reinforcing. We'll continue to do that ritual to make ourselves feel better. So in a way, they kind of are related, that they've got that initial negative association, which is then throughout history just developed throughout the population.
So even though we can't tell where these superstitions come from or how they impact us, they still impact us anyway. Is that correct?
Yeah, we still get the impact. It was, you can actually see superstitions develop in psychology. There's famous psychologist called B.F. Skinner, who created the operant conditioning, the positive and negative reinforcement. And he actually shown how he could make a pigeon become superstitious. And what he would do was, there's like little old video clips on YouTube, quite old footage, but he would drop food down to a pigeon on a completely random moment. It didn't matter what they were doing. That was irrelevant. It wasn't a time sequence. It was a uncontrolled random event where he'll drop them a food pellet, but the pigeon would perform different functions. So historically, he used to get them to like hit a light and then they would get a food pellet. So they would start by doing that, no food dropped. So then they panic and they then lift up one wing. Oh, food dropped. Brilliant. Next time I lift up my wing again. Next time the food doesn't come. Oh, I'll try the other wing. I'll do a little turn. And it was really interesting because it shows how the pigeon, they're not, you know, sentient or conscious in that way, but they are still performing these actions to try to get their reward. And he said this is literally the same as superstitions in humans, that, you know, one time we got rewarded for doing something that might have been staying in or, you know, whatever it could have been at that time. Or like when you press the lift button and you press it a couple of times and then, oh, it was the third time I pressed it that the lift actually came. So then you tell yourself, that's what I need to do in future. I was rewarded for that one time. But that reward was completely random. The lift probably was going to just come at that moment anyway. But you've kind of noticed it was when you did it the third time that that's when you got the result. So he said, and all behaviorists say this, that humans aren't really any more complicated than animals. So that's why they turn to animals, because ethically they can research them. And they say that humans literally respond in the same way. And there's some brilliant clips out there where they've done it with humans, where they've dropped them rewards in the face of kind of points. And they were randomly awarded those points. But whatever they were doing at that time, oh, I was popping a yellow balloon and we got a point. I'm now going to keep popping a yellow balloon, but the points don't come. And that has that same issue. And we see it with gamblers as well. It's a part of the gambler's fallacy that they think, oh, that time when I got the jackpot, I had done three presses of that button and then one press of that button. So if I do that again, I'll then get the reward. But it doesn't work that way. And that's how we think superstitions are formed, through that repetition of operant conditioning.
Where do social sciences stand in regard to that day? Say that someone is coming to you with certain superstitions. Are you going to try to make this person reason with them?
I think when it comes to kind of students, or if you had a patient who was superstitious, you wouldn't try to change their beliefs, even though psychologists as a whole wouldn't believe in Friday the 13th or superstitions. They wouldn't try and change their beliefs because they know that those beliefs serve a purpose. And that the beliefs that we tell ourselves, some of them, you know, you could have had for 10, 20, 30 years. So if you come in and tell someone to change the way that they believe, that could actually be quite damaging to them. And have they got another way of making sense of the world around them? And then that could lead to mental health issues or things like that if they haven't got that in place. But as a whole, psychologists would always try to understand why so many people believe in superstitions and why so many people have this fear of Friday the 13th or Tuesday the 13th or Friday the 17th or the number four. They would be fascinated by how many people are affected, and that's what would make them want to study it. So you'd have kind of your cognitive psychologists who would say it's faulty thinking, that it's these confirmation biases, it's these deals that they've made with themselves, it's these cognitive shortcuts to understanding the world around them. They would look solely at how the mind is processing that information. You've got your behaviourists that I mentioned who would focus on negative associations in the first instance, and that would be a form of classical conditioning. And then that classical conditioning continues as a phobia through the negative reinforcement from operant conditioning and the superstitious pigeons. And then you've got kind of social influence or social psychology, who always look at the people around you and kind of popular culture at that time. So they would look at kind of the role that Friday the 13th as a film has played, what impact it's had in society to develop so many people with this phobia, to the point that Italians, although their initial phobia is Friday the 17th, they are now also afraid of Friday the 13th, purely because of books and films that have kind of exaggerated this unlucky day. And then you've got your social learning theorists, who are kind of in between social and behaviorism. And they would look a little bit at how your mind processes who you want to imitate, but that ultimately you always are going to imitate any role model. So, for instance, there's famous celebrities out there who have come out and talked about having the phobia of Friday the 13th. And then they would obviously say that's going to influence you. But seeing parents, older siblings, or people at school, you know, you would then copy and imitate them as well. There's a branch of psychology called anomalistic psychology, which specializes looking at all of kind of the unusual phenomenon in the world, like Friday the 13th. But they would kind of look at it from more to do with kind of a probability basis. So they would actually research and see if, you know, Friday the 13th is genuinely an unlucky day. And they would do it in terms of, you know, statistically, how unlucky is it in comparison to other days? And on the whole, all of the kind of branches of psychology would be trying to debunk that Friday the 13th is unlucky, that it is something to be superstitious and worried about. But as I said, they would still want to understand why people feel that, why. And it is interesting from a nurture point of view how so much of the population are influenced by that fear, and the way that that's been transmitted through, you know, the use of media, the use of TV, films, is really interesting how that message has, you know, gone through history, but also become probably stronger, probably since 1980, where that kind of fear has developed even more so. So they would be fascinated in researching it, definitely.
It sounds like someone passing on the torch, and the moment we receive it, we start running with it, without questioning where this torch has come from. All we need to do is take it and to do what that previous someone did with it. I just find it interesting. As you said, though, Friday the 13th is also the classic summer camp slasher 1980 film written by Victor Miller and Ron Kurz, and directed by Sean S. Cunningham. A group of camp counselors in an attempt to reopen a summer camp where a kid had drowned years ago, are stalked and killed one by one by someone who allegedly seeks revenge. Is this an attempt to turn a superstition or an unlucky day into a day that symbolizes horror?
I think so. I think, as with all great horror films, they attach to something that people are already fearful of. And Friday the 13th was already, as we know, as we said throughout history, something people were already superstitious of, worried of, you know, that they're not flying on those days, that they're not buying homes on those days, that they're not traveling on those days, you know, that they're staying indoors on those days. That it's such a genius idea to attach to such a widespread, you know, maybe low level fear to begin with, but to attach to that and then create a franchise from that, that then, you know, has probably definitely developed that fear and that superstition of it being an unlucky day. So I think they've done absolutely brilliantly. You know, I wish I was there to be a part of that at the very beginning in 1980, because it's such a genius idea to attach that. And it does show kind of how the phobias are spread through cultural transmission, which would really annoy a lot of the biological and evolutionary psychologists that like to think that fears, like common fears like the spiders and things like that, are inherited, when actually we can see that it's cultural transmission. It's through observing the media, through watching films, through talking about those films, that that then becomes kind of something scarier. And I think a lot of superstitions are linked with death. Like I was saying about, you know, the Chinese relationship with the number four, because the word, the pronunciation of the number four sounds similar to death. You know, a lot of superstition is to avoid death, to avoid that negative outcome. So it makes sense that the unlucky day would kind of match up with this symbolising of horror, because ultimately that's the greatest fear, is fear of death, fear of dying. And we have our Thanos drive, according to Freud, our death instinct, and we also have our libido, our life instinct, and these drive us, these energy forces drive us. So we're always going to be trying to avoid death, and hence superstitions are our weird way of kind of making a deal to avoid that death. So I think Friday the 13th as a film, very, very clever, because they've tapped into that fear, and it has now become kind of associated with horror. Whereas before, there was a book in 1907 by Thomas Lawson, and it was all about kind of Friday the 13th as a superstition, and Friday the 13th as basically it created a panic on the Wall Street market, you know, in America, where people were buying or selling less because of it being Friday the 13th, and it created a widespread panic. But at that point, in 1907, that probably strengthened the connection with Friday the 13th, but it was still only seen as a superstition. It really is the film that's brought it into it being a horror, that this is now connected to death, and obviously being a slasher film, and, you know, the number of deaths that you get in the franchise, you know, it's going to make that connection, and definitely it's now come to symbolise horror. And we see it, you know, on Halloween, people are dressing up as Jason, they've got their hockey masks, and, you know, they're going out there to kind of play around with that idea. So I think they've definitely made the connection from superstition to horror.
That's really interesting. The director stated that the actors he wanted were, quote unquote, good-looking kids who you might see in a Pepsi commercial. Why is that? Is this how bullies look like? Or is it that not too many people care if unattractive people die? Or is it something else?
Well, I think with the bullies, I think kind of a lot of the media, TV, series, films, they do focus on that kind of stereotype in the media that, you know, bullies are the popular kids, they are the attractive ones. And that attractiveness in young people symbolises power, because a lot of young people are struggling with identity crises, and they all want to kind of just fit in and be part of the norm. They don't like kind of not fitting in. That makes them stand out of the crowd. They don't like that attention. So for young people particularly, I think being attractive is seen as really important, and how the young people desire to kind of fit in to the extent that they'll buy that identity and they'll try and buy the latest goods. So it's kind of interesting that they said, you know, someone who could appear in a Pepsi commercial, because they would be attractive people who would be selling items. And young people as a target audience would be people who are willing to buy. They have disposable incomes. They want to buy their identity and fit in with what we call the in-group. And the in-group is the group you want to belong to, and the out-group are the groups you don't belong to. And we tend to see that in a lot of films, especially, that American high schools are made up of the in-groups and out-groups, the in-groups being the cool kids, you know, the ones who are sports players or popular kids or attractive. And then we make the association that they're also the bullies, and then the out-groups are all the awkward kids who don't kind of fit the norms or fit that mold, and then they get labelled and bullied by the popular kids. But that's what we see in a lot of the American TV and film, but in reality that's not the case. Some sociological studies, so one by Paul Willis, he looks at anti-school subcultures. So these are children who have rejected school. They can't fit into school, and they tend to be kind of working class. They, rather than, you know, the popular kids are normally the rich kids, the middle class kids who can afford to buy the identity and all of those things. In anti-school subcultures, they're the working class ones. And he would argue it's normally those who are probably more likely to be the bullies, because they bully the middle class kids. And they bully them in a way we have to kind of have sympathy with them. They bully them because all of school is designed for middle class kids. And they, in sociology, they argue that school itself as an institution is aimed at the middle class, that the curriculum is middle class. I mean, there's talks at the moment in the UK bringing Latin in into state schools because they want to even up the elitist playing field. You know, that schools as a whole are aimed for that middle class curriculum to give the students cultural capital to go on to do well at job interviews or university or wherever it is that they go. So in reality, what we see in state schools in the UK from research that Paul Willis and Mack and Gale is that it's actually the working class kids who don't fit into school because they can't access that middle class curriculum, and because they haven't got middle class parents who understand the school system, that they then reject school, and then they pick on the kind of well off, the posher middle class kids. So it's kind of not their fault, not that I'm pro-bullying, but it's not their fault that they're in that situation, that they know that there aren't, you know, there isn't going to be jobs for them afterwards. They're not going to get into university because a lot of the working class jobs no longer exist in the UK, like the mining and factories and things like that, that they then have to get angry and they kind of almost take it out on the middle class kids who have everything their way. So it's kind of an opposite picture to what we see in a lot of the American films in the UK. But also going to the point about, is it that we only care about people who are attractive or unattractive? That has been a thing in psychology. We call it the halo effect, that the one thing we know about a stranger is how attractive they are, because that's all you can see about them. And we assume positive things with a positive appearance. So if they're seen as attractive, we then assume that all of their other characteristics, like their personality, their intelligence, you know, anything else about them is also positive. And we've seen it throughout time where in courtrooms, you know, pretty people get smaller sentences, not as pretty people get longer sentences. So we do kind of have that halo effect that maybe, I don't want to say that that's the case for everyone, but that most people seem to care more when it's an attractive person. And we also have to think of the norms of society. You know, what we find as attractive obviously changes throughout time, but we also see kind of what does the audience want, and they tend to want that attractive majority, the norm, and it tends to be that white, middle class, attractive, very slim person usually, or very muscly if it's a man. kind of those norms. And it, you know, you can even make a few leaps, a few jumps, and that's how you can get to why, you know, certain cases aren't followed up by police in the UK, because maybe there's arguably some form of institutional racism, especially historically when we look at the Stephen Lawrence murder, that wasn't followed up initially, and there's lots of complications with that because he was black and he was a minority, so they made assumptions about him, and that made them not want to really investigate it. Obviously, this is going back into the 80s and 90s. And the other aspect, I think, with the film and the director themselves, you know, they are trying to sell the film, and they know that sex and attractiveness sells and who their target audience is. But also it's very convenient, you know, that the killer is after teenagers who are having sex, who, you know, are pretty much half naked throughout that, you know, teenagers running around in their underwear, and it's raining outside. Oh, I'll just stick a quick waterproof coat over my underwear as I run outside. You know, that it's a very convenient way of having the film set up. And maybe it's a paper thin excuse. Maybe, you know, other films might have a serial killer who only kills strippers so that they're able to show strippers in the film. Maybe it's a way of getting the film to sell, is having kind of that attractive, sexy element to the film will always attract the young people as their target audience.
I've noticed sometimes that when, for example, a young, good-looking girl has died, someone will say something like, "Oh my God, she was so beautiful," which makes you wonder, so what if she wasn't beautiful or that beautiful? Would that make it less tragic?
This is the thing. I was going to say, it's fairly recent, but the Sarah Everard case, which received so much attention because obviously she died tragically, but yeah, because she was white, she was middle class, she was so beautiful. And then there's a bit of backlash at the time because they said, whilst Sarah Everard has died, there's been this young black girl who has died that no one's talked about. You know, there's been this young black boy who's died and no one's talked about it. And it's that kind of the media and who they choose to focus on. You know, deaths are happening every day and we can't report on every one of them. But why there is that focus on the beautiful people who die, it's a really uncomfortable discussion to have. But I think it's one that the media are starting to have.
As this is a huge topic, and I would particularly like to focus on ethnic minorities, appearance and society, would you be interested in coming back?
Yeah, of course.
Thank you already. Going back to Friday the 13th, contrary to the Halloween franchise, the Friday the 13th has very little music. It seems that when Jason Voorhees appears, music appears too. Is it an artistic difference or is it something else? How does that reflect on the killer's image?
I think the music in horror films always helps to build the tension. And I think, again, it's really clever how Friday the 13th saves that music, that it's okay to have, you know, those vast majority of quiet times and then have that tension build when the camera changes to the point of view camera, when then the music starts. So it's kind of almost preparing you. You know he's around, you know that there's going to get stabbed, you know, in a moment someone's going to get stabbed. You know that that's going to happen. And even though you know it's going to happen, it gets you tense. You know the build-up is coming. And I think it's really clever how, when was mentioned about associations, you then have made that association with, you know, Jason, the music, and in a way that makes that connection even stronger, because music is incredible in our brains. It's one of those things that patients with Alzheimer's or dementia, they still remember certain pieces of music, and it's a way to kind of bring them back to parts of their youth. So music somehow jumps the memory of, we normally have to go through different memory stores, sensory memory, short-term memory, and then eventually we get to the long-term memory. Music bypasses all of that. Also smells do, and other senses, but music is one of them. And we see it in, you know, classics like Jaws, where those two notes make you terrified and you know that the shark's coming. And that kind of, it just makes that connection. It makes it kind of a timeless classic that then every time you hear that music, you get tense. You know what's coming. You know who's responsible. The camera angle shifts and changes. It gets a bit wobbly as he's walking. And you know what's coming. And I think it definitely probably makes the experience stronger because of those silent moments compared to Halloween. I think it's a very clever way of making it jump into your long-term memory easier and in a way maybe scaring you more. I don't know if there's been, I couldn't find any research kind of into that. I mean, there's, you know, lots of research into how horror films are successful and how they do what they do. But it's, there has to be, I would have thought, some sort of connection between how music can jump to the long term and then that association that the music is reserved only for one character. I thought that was really, really clever to build that intense association.
Speaking of, the famous ch-ch-ch is actually k-k-k-mum-mum-mum to sound like kill-kill-kill-mum-mum-mum, referencing Mrs. Voorhees' schizophrenia. Do you think that the date, Friday the 13th, is in any shape or form connected to mental illness or superstition? Consequently, is superstition somehow connected to mental illness?
I love this question. This is such a fascinating area, partly because I used to work in care. I used to work with individuals with paranoid schizophrenia. And of the three individuals I worked with, so a very small sample, can't make too many generalizations, I would say two out of the three were extremely superstitious as well. So it's interesting if that is a connection. In the first film, Friday the 13th, 1980 film, the police, after I think it's an hour in, the police officer actually, while he's, I forgot the name of the guy who runs the, Christie, is it? The guy who runs the camp, while he's in the car with him, he brings up, oh, you know, it's Friday the 13th, it's a full moon, there's always more crime at this time. And then he kind of argues back and goes, oh, well, it's science out of a coincidence. You know, it's not a cause and effect, it's only a correlation. So there has been this connection between the idea of a full moon and mental illness, and hence people are superstitious about a full moon. When we used to have insane asylums in the UK, more people were put into insane asylums around the time of a full moon. And that's where the word lunatic comes from. Lunar meaning the moon, lunatic for someone, an old phrase that would use for someone with a mental health issue. So there's definitely a connection within kind of the people who maybe do the diagnosing and the general population that historically, at least, you know, if we went through, and I think we've talked about before, the history of mental illness, there is a connection with the moons and, you know, time of the month and how that affects mental health. And how, you know, women are kind of seen more negatively in that way because they have a monthly cycle and people say that that makes their mental health worse and things like that. Even so, I've got a friend who, I always use this example in class, who when she went to the doctor to be diagnosed with depression, this was a doctor, you know, a couple of years ago, the doctor actually asked them, is their depression worse during a full moon? So this is a scientist, you know, someone of a GP profession who's asking, is your mental health worse in a full moon period? So it is interesting how we have this kind of connection between superstitions of full moon, Friday the 13th, and mental illness. And perhaps I was doing quite a bit of research into this area. As I said, it's something that fascinates me. And I found something where they're saying perhaps maybe being aware of those superstitions is what brings that sense of order. And someone who has a mental health issue won't feel as much control as someone who doesn't have a mental health issue, especially, you know, if you've been hospitalized, you kind of give up a lot of your control when you're hospitalized. So maybe making those connections with these superstitions brings back that control of the uncontrollable events. And performing the rituals that go along with the superstitions. So, you know, jinx touch wood or punch someone in the shoulder if you've seen three magpies, or whatever it is, all of those sorts of superstitions. Those rituals will definitely give that person a sense of power, a sense of agency, that they've done something, they've been able to actually physically control the future, control reality. So perhaps that does help them in that sense, is to perform those rituals. And then if they know the rules of society or the rules of the world order in terms of these superstitions, then they know how to play by those rules. So I do think there could well be a link between mental health and superstitions. Not in the sense that everyone who has a mental health issue is superstitious. I don't think that's the case. But I would be interested to see, you know, if there's research out there that shows maybe there's a greater incidence where people with schizophrenia are maybe more susceptible to being superstitious. There could perhaps be the links there, maybe, but it would need large enough samples. There's consent issues with being able to research people with mental health issues, because arguably they might not be able to give consent, especially if they're schizophrenic, and they won't be able to kind of be able to perform, you know, having that consent, because they might be in an altered state or hearing voices. But no, I really like kind of that link to maybe saying kill, you know, kill the mum, you know, it's kind of suggesting that. And it's worth pointing out as well, obviously, people with schizophrenia, yes, they hear voices. The voices do tend to be voices that are internalized, you know, from our parents or anyone who's been significant in your life. But not all those voices are negative. So obviously, hear the voices, very negative, go out and kill. And it's, I know obviously we all know this, but it's worth kind of just pointing out people with paranoid schizophrenia aren't murderers. You know, that isn't, there is no kind of correlation between those two things. But obviously they do hear voices, and they are of people that are close to them. And yes, they can be negative, but they're not ones that normally are saying go off and kill. They're normally, you know, basically they're normally scrutinizing the individual. So they're normally saying that the person with the schizophrenia is, you know, worthless or things like that. So they're not kind of externally aggressive out to other people. They're normally quite inwardly, internally aggressive as voices. But definitely, I don't know, I think there could be some historic connection that maybe has again just stuck with people between superstitions and mental illness. It'll definitely be an interesting one to research, kind of the incidence, the number of people with mental health issues and people with superstitions.
While we are at it, in Psycho, the son pretends to be his mother, whereas in Friday the 13th, it is the mother who pretends to be her son. Both of them end up on a killing spree. Is there a cinematic or actual message regarding the mother-son bond?
The mother-son bond is huge in psychology. Maybe because most of the psychologists that were famous at kind of the beginning of psychology were male. So perhaps maybe that's why there is such a focus. But there are so many theories that focus on the idea. I'll talk about just three. I have to mention Sigmund Freud, father of modern day psychology, because he kind of laid the groundwork. And you can visit Freud's house in London. There's also his first home in Vienna. And then because of the Holocaust, he had to move over to London. But if you see either of those houses, you see the pictures that are up of his own mum and kind of the relationship he had with her. And then he went on to create psychodynamic psychology, which focuses on the unconscious and how the libido, the life instinct, and the thanos, the death instinct, are placed in different areas of the body throughout your development. So there's five stages of development. I'm only going to mention one. And one of them is the phallic stage, which is between the ages of 3 and 5. And he said that's where boys unconsciously go through the Oedipus complex. So between the ages of 3 and 5, boys unconsciously desire to possess their mum. So a lot of people took that as kind of sexual. Which it isn't. It's more that they want all of the mother's attention just for themselves. They don't want to share the mother with their dad or a sibling. They want to own the mum and have her all to themselves. And in that way, hence why it gets misinterpreted as being something quite sexual. And people say, oh, you get a partner who, you know, looks like your opposite sex parent and things like that. There may be some evidence in that, but I don't know scientifically if there is. So during that phallic stage, they go through the Oedipus complex, and that's where they have this desire for the mum, the boys do, and they have to resolve that conflict because they know that that's not allowed. They know that that's not okay. And if the dad finds out, he's going to castrate them. And so they've just found their new favourite toy. Freud called it the Widdler, because the boy he was working with was German. We would call it the penis. And the idea that the boy's just found that, he started to play with that, he enjoys how it feels. And then if the dad finds out that he unconsciously desires the mum, that he's going to take that away. So he develops castration anxiety. And that tends to be linked with phobias. It tends to be a key starting point for a lot of phobias, that the young boy can't acknowledge that he's afraid of his dad. So he projects that fear onto something else. And Freud looked at a case of little hands and a white horse and how he projected that fear onto the horse. To resolve that conflict, he has to become similar to the father to then receive the love of the mother in a socially acceptable way. And by becoming similar to the father, he might take on his masculine traits. So it's used as a gender theory. He might also internalize his father. And that's where we see kind of moral development. And we get what's called the superego from our parents, which is our morality principle. It tells us what's right and what's wrong. So we develop that from our parents, and that's that internalization. And hence, some people have said that's connected to schizophrenia, that when you hear voices, it does tend to be your parents, that maybe that's the superego coming out of the unconscious into the conscious. We don't know. Freud was doing his theories, you know, well before there was scientific evidence and brain scans and things like that. A theory connected to Freud is the schizoprogenic mother theory, that one of the causes of schizophrenia is a cold, harsh, rejecting mother. And again, it's that kind of relationship between mum and son or daughter. And there's slightly more prevalence of males with schizophrenia than there is females. And the idea that because she's so harsh and so rejecting, and that boy is so desperate for the love, that this then creates the boy to kind of look internally and has that conflict with himself through the voices that are then created. However, schizophrenic mother theory has been heavily criticised for the blame that it places on the mother. And a lot of these theories put the blame on the mother, partly because of the time period in which those theories were constructed. And, you know, obviously in those times it was solely the mother who probably did all of the child rearing. Whereas in most European countries, there's a more share between that child rearing. And a lot of people have argued maybe it's family dysfunction, that the family has too much conflict rather than it just being the mother. And maybe that's what causes schizophrenia. And then the last theory that talks about the mum and the son. And as I said, there's so many theories out there that look at the mum and the son, but the ones that seem most relevant to kind of this idea in Psycho and in Friday the 13th is Bowlby. And John Bowlby worked alongside the government, and he was interested when the children were sent away from their homes during World War II out into the countryside, so the cities that were getting bombed, the children would be safe. He then investigated how that separation affected them in later life and in their attachments. And he said that children have a monotropic attachment. So that's one strong bond. And he said that's to the primary caregiver, but he said the primary caregiver is usually the mum. And hence he's doing his theory before 1950s, you know, that emphasis is always going to be on the mum. And he argued that if the mother with their children, but you know, here we're looking at the son, if that separation continues for too long or is disrupted, especially in kind of what he called a critical period, which in some resources he says 0 to 2.5 years. In some he says there's a sensitive period up to 5 years. So kind of, let's say, the first 5 years of their life, if there's a long disrupted attachment between the mother and the child, that the child will go on to become an affectionless psychopath. And he then did a study called 44 Juvenile Thieves. And in that study, he looked at those 44 thieves and compared them to another sample. And he found that the majority of them had had this disrupted attachment to their mum. And that's what made them become thieves. And they had no remorse. They were affectionless. And they were very selfish. They were psychopathic in the way in which they were. So perhaps, you know, Psycho's character may be, you know, taking on the mother's role with the skeleton and the wig, and then Friday the 13th, the mother, you know, internalizing her son's voice as she's going around in the first film, and then Jason goes on later on. Perhaps there is such a strong bond between, you know, the importance of that first initial attachment and how close the mum and son are, particularly in Freudian theory, that that is the main bond. Freud talked about girls. He talked about the Electra complex, but he said that girls will never develop in the same way as boys, and they'll never have that same strong bond because they'll always have penis envy. They'll always be annoyed, you know, that their penis was taken away from the beginning. So maybe this explains why the mother and son particularly is such a strong bond.
Extremely interesting, honestly. Similar to what I said earlier, I would like to have a separate episode on killers and masks. For the sake of this one, though, does the hockey mask symbolize something? If yes, what is it?
Well, this was a really difficult one because the mask I can understand, like say, if we go on to talk about killers and masks in another time, because masks themselves straight away are scary for people because they create this uncanny valley that the person looks slightly human, but they're not human enough. And then that makes other people feel uncomfortable. And then when you look at the hockey mask, it's particularly good at that because, you know, there's no mouth. You can't really see the eyes. There's big dark pits where the eyes are. You know, that mask itself would make you feel probably more uncomfortable. It's kind of human-esque as well, you know, arguably the white colour of the mask, you know, it makes it feel like you're looking at a human at first, but then you're not. And obviously with his character and himself, is he human? Is he not human? Throughout the franchise, it changes so many times. He's a spirit at one point. You know, it adds that unknown, and we don't like that. We don't like when things look almost human. That's something that kind of perverses us. It's maybe a biological thing that instinctively perverses us. There's also all the tiny little holes in the mask. And I think I've mentioned in a previous episode with you about trypophobia, which is when there's clusters of small holes, like in crumpets or sponges and things like that. So that is a phobia in itself. So that would make that hockey mask particularly even more fearful. And then the other thing we really don't like as humans is when we can't see someone's eyes. So that's why it's so important, you know, the masks we've all been wearing for the pandemic, you know, they only cover the bottom part of the face. You can still see the eyes because we lost so much communication when we couldn't see the mouth because we rely so much on nonverbal communication when we're talking. But the eyes, as they say, are the, you know, way to the soul. And for us, we need to be able to imagine what someone is thinking. We call that theory of mind, and we don't develop it until after the age of 5, where we can imagine that somebody else's thoughts are different to our own. And it's really important for us to be able to see into their eyes, to be able to make sense of what they are thinking of doing, or how they're taking that conversation, or how they're feeling. So the fact, you know, the hockey mask, we can't see his eyes, it's really, really dark, makes that even more eerie because you've got nothing to go off. You can't read the mouth and you can't read the eyes. In Western culture, a study by Yuki, he argued, so he compared American students with Japanese students, And he argued that American students, when looking at emoticons, will focus on their eyes to know what someone's feeling, whereas Japanese focus on the mouth to know what someone's feeling. Actually, I think it may have been the other way around. I think Japanese were eyes and Americans were mouth. So if you've taken both of those two things away, you're left with a complete sense of uncertainty. We don't know what they were feeling. I was interested why a hockey mask, and I thought maybe teenage schools in America, maybe, you know, that audience, that's a thing, you know, all of that. And then I did a bit of research, and apparently from one of the websites that I was reading, he said that when he was filming, they were doing a lighting moment, so they were testing the lighting. The script called for a mask, but they didn't actually have a mask prepared, and they needed it to test the lighting. And then he happened to have a hockey mask. So maybe it was purely accidental, but if it was, it was very clever because of it taking out both the eyes and the mouth, leaving kind of that really uncomfortable feeling when he's wearing the hockey mask.
That answers my question, so for now I'll leave it there. One last question for you. What was something that you particularly liked in the film, and what was something that you didn't?
I think the best thing is the point of view camera angle. I thought that's really clever for its time. I thought it really kind of made you uncomfortable because you almost become the killer. It sounds a bit dramatic, but because you've seen it from their point of view, and you know, you then are cut to the victims getting all nervous, they know it's coming, then there's the cut away for the murder scene, then the cut back and all of a sudden they've got an axe in the head or whatever it might be. I thought that was really good because you are almost put into their position, but also it's really, really terrifying because in that view, all you're seeing is the reactions of the people in front of you, the potential victims. So that builds even more tension. And maybe it paved the way for kind of Blair Witch Project, maybe even Peep Show as, you know, a very long running TV comedy. But it's a very clever, you know, for saying how early this franchise begun, I thought that was a really clever kind of twist. Even that the camera, I think I mentioned before, was a bit rocky at times because he's walking up the stairs, you know, or things like that. I really liked kind of that angle. For me, Greater Sweetness. Maybe the depth of some of the characters, and maybe a missed opportunity on some of the characters to come back. You know, obviously not the ones that kill, well, some of those do come back. But, you know, actually seeing kind of like at the end of the first film, the girl, I can't remember her name, who's in the boat, it would have been nice if she'd come back in the next one. I thought that would have been interesting to see the dynamic because she just killed his mum. You know, obviously that's not going to be great. So I thought, you know, the characters are such literal throwaway characters because it's a slasher film. You're going to always have that. And I think maybe a bit more depth of the characters would have been nicer.
Without knowing it, possibly, you're spot on. She was meant to come back, but a huge fan started stalking her, so she stated that she didn't really want to return or be known for that role. Therefore, they had to kill off her character.
Ah, I didn't know that. Yeah, because that would have been an interesting angle to take it.
Michelle, thank you very much for your time. As always, it is very much appreciated.
Thank you. I enjoyed doing it.
I'll see you soon.
Bye.
Good night. As we are nearing the end, please give me a review and don't forget to share and subscribe. You can find all of my podcasts, film reviews and analysis on my website, kgazpro.com. If you also feel like supporting my effort to explore the genre, please feel free to support me on patreon.com/kgazpro. Any support is much appreciated and valued. Personal insecurities, phobias, superstition and associations we are trying to find meaning in blend in our minds, creating a cocktail of emotions about what to believe and why. While the social sciences research the aforementioned thoroughly, the film taps into our fears and transcends to real life. The mask, the blood, the urban legend, the soundtrack and problems of modern society were all put into the mix and created a cult slasher horror that generated a franchise that strengthened all we thought we knew about that day. Friday the 13th will always be a special day for all of us, as it's one of those cases where the blending of history and myth shape us in ways we, more often than not, don't fully comprehend and acknowledge. So thank you for staying with me all the way. These podcasts are for horror fans who have the passion to delve into the horror genre to its core. Feel free to make requests, suggestions, or ask about anything you would be interested in discovering about the genre and its echoing aftershock to the world we live in. Horror elicits fear through fiction and terror through facts. It is gory and it is psychological. It is caused by supernatural entities as much as it is caused by our deranged next-door neighbor. Horror can haunt our nightmares no less than it can haunt our questionable reality. So remember, the son of Erebus and Nyx always awaits to cross the rivers Styx and Acheron.